Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
All right, folks, will be starting here very shortly.
Hey, good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS.
Appreciate you so much for that. Apparently here I'm a little more busted than I thought. Forgive me here. Folks, one moment. Looks like the GUI has changed there a little, Mr. Edward. Can I be heard? I'm in it now. I'm looking for the record there. The GUI is completely
already
changed.
Started it.
Okay.
Started it.
All right, perfect. Here we go. Bear with me here. We'll be better suited tomorrow night. All right, here we go. All right, good evening, everybody. Martin Michelson here. Welcome to another weekly evening installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight we are discussing a most interesting aspect in law. My name is Martin Michelson. I'll be your moderator for this evening's conference, brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is a direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may in any way, shape, or form be deemed by you as legal advice. If you're on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I ask very politely that you hang up the phone and immediately disconnect from this call. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everybody in no uncertain terms that anyone looking for legal advice simply has no place or business here on any of these calls. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America as a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, nobody here is able to offer you any kind of legal advice. Should you require legal advice, it's my suggestion to you, not my advice, just my suggestion, that you get an attorney, someone that your state sanctions to give you advice in law. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. They're just people saying what they might do were they similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are still just that. They're people's opinions and nothing more. It's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. So let's go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law very quickly. First of all, I'll take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com. If you look in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a little picture of the Constitution, tiny little picture there. You click on that, and a separate page will come up that just has two items on it. Those two items are certainly most important, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly, on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure, better known as American jurisprudence or AMJUR. The rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means that you have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you would find yourself in. So, but on the right now, of course, we've got the common law default process, nationally known for its high win rates in traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that's not really why it's on this page. The reason that you find it here is that you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learn about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of almost acts like a real-life homework assignment. For a lot of folks, it's their first time, committing to some kind of action. So it gives you all the basic, between those two, it's going to give you all the basic foundation of information that you need to know. And then it's going to give you, a real life scenario exercise, where you can put it to action. And of course, traffic scenarios are sadly a huge part of day-to-day lives. So, for a lot of us, it's only a matter of time before we need it for that anyway. But, folks that seem to have a little bit, they're willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate in traffic scenarios. Forgive me here. Also on the subject of your remedies and the law, you're probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of your remedies and the law, you're met with a blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the sites that you're visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups that set your remedies and the law. Your Remedy Isn't the Law is just one of a couple of dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you will do just that at your leisure. Do you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that can give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation? Email me, mm@yourremediesintheLaw.com. Once again, I'm Martin Michelson, so mm@yourremediesintheLaw.com, or you can call the 1-800-625-4250, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. All right, on to the next subject, Brass Fire Communications, formerly known as Statewide Communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. I'll tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. So what it is, it's a private communications platform that enables you to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. So essentially how it works is this. It's actually a very easy setup, continue here, click next, put this information in there. Very, very user-friendly, pretty much tells you everything that you need to do. And then it's going to ask you at one point there, towards the end, what are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, what else? Asset protection, veterans' rights, maybe basic personal health rights, things like that. Pretty much anything that you can think of, you're going to find a category that's very, very, very close to it. And so when you when your setup is complete, when you finish doing all this, putting in all this information, it puts you together with, well, think of it kind of like a social media. you know, like a social network. So it's going to put you in contact with people that are interested in the same stuff that you're interested in, that live in your, you know, general area, or, you know, whatever you've told, whatever, you know, you put in the field there for, you know, how large a range of a circle do you want to expand out to. And so the idea here, the point of it, is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man, where the common man can speak with other folks, you know, usually more often than not, you know, in this local area, that maybe perhaps have, you know, been through this type of scenario, and they can just, you know, share with one another, you know, what their, you know, experience was like, and how did it make them feel, and all that kind of good stuff. And so if you haven't already done so, please do sign up. There's no charge for it. All right. So wrapping all this up, if you're in need of legal advice, or you need somebody to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney, folks. It's really that simple. But if there's a way, you know, a private place that you can go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that are like-minded, you just jump online one day and say, you know, this happened to me today. First person come back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that, you know, they should be able to do that. I don't agree with that. That's not fair. Well, that's probably not going to be a tremendous amount of help to you. But the next person that comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do, where I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and I'd go down to my local county courthouse and go to the law library and get the law dictionary and look at these terms, look at these specific set of terms. And maybe the next person, you know, says, those all sound like fantastic ideas. And also, there's a particular website that you could check out. They've got some wonderful educational materials that might assist in your learning. And then you go on some diligence, some of your own due diligence based on what you, you know, what you read in there. This is a real life scenario that is quite easy, actually, once you use it a couple times and you get comfortable with the you know, this grass fire communications, that's what it does. It puts everybody together, and it's just people sharing their opinions. But if you follow up on that and you do your due diligence, you educate yourself, then what's going to happen sooner than later is for most folks, they're going to figure out pretty quick that it's not as difficult as you initially thought, you know, that it was in reality. You know, it's, for most scenarios, you're following the same path, you know, And the more you, you know, the more you learn, the more you do your due diligence, the easier it gets. So, all right. As we said, of course, so there's no fee for grass fire communications. Now, for whatever reason, you're not able to do the grass fire communications, you have freedomsradio.com. Maybe if you're just on the road, you don't want to deal with the card process or, you know, whatever the situation, you know, for your subscription. Your image in the law wants to make sure that you, you know, have an option that you can, you know, still listen to, you know, to these information providers. And so that's why we offer the Freedoms Radio. You get the first 30 days free to evaluate that. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month to auto pay to your credit card or your PayPal. And if you're not aware, if you're new here, all these calls are recorded. And so you've got years of archives that you can go back. My personal opinion, that's some of the real value comes in, is the fact that you can pick a topic and you can go back months, years, and listen to, you know, different calls where, you know, people called in and had, you know, unique scenarios. And who knows, you might find that, you know, relatively quickly you come across a scenario that's extremely similar to your own. and now you're able to hear, you know, what their opinion was on it, how they went about it. So, all right. So if you want to pick up a membership to Your Remedies of the Law, it's very easy. You click the register button, and that's your basic information that's put in there. And then, like you said, the $10 a month, you just kind of follow the prompts from there. All right, there's also a question box where you can type in a question. You can click submit. As long as it's within a certain call hours, your written question will pop up on the moderator screen there. Of course, we're talking about Freedom's Radio. And we do our best to read out every single one of those questions. And, of course, as long as they're appropriate. And so, you don't always get to talk, directly with the information provider, every single time. But, they do, read those questions out. And so if you just, be patient, they'll, they will get that addressed and you'll be able to hear, at least, a good thorough answer, to whatever your question was. All right, so winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware, if you will. Your Remedies in the Law is under the umbrella of Americans Restoring America. When you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you're doing just that. The information provider's payment for advertising, forgive me here. The information provider's pay, for advertising at Your Remedies in the Law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider, along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. So when you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own, just simply because they can't be found. And they make sure of that. And we just simply make the introductions. Not all teaching efforts by the info provider is always going to be successful. Everybody hopes for the best. We plan for the best. Believe me when I tell you we aim for the best. But sometimes things happen. Best laid plans, if you will. But we emphasize that the intent, though, is always to be successful. And if you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit yourremediesinthelaw.com/testimonials. And see what others have had to say, about our products and services. So now let's touch also very quickly on the subject of refunds or your refund policy here for Your Remedies in the Law. There is none. Well, not at Your Remedies in the Law anyway. Of course, when you call and if you decide to utilize a process, for example, and, you go off with the information provider. So the discussion of a refund or a credit, essentially, folks, would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider. But I'll give you folks a tip. It's got to be an extenuating circumstance. You're expected, essentially, to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right. I guess lastly, pertaining here to all of our information providers at Your Remedies in the Law, we want to remind everybody that all of our speakers at all these conferences are guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn. But please, let's always be civil. The size of a question, if closed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it. All right, well, that's my rant for this evening. Now, our speaker that we have tonight is Brother John. And let's see here. Brother John's going to be speaking about, what do we have here, Mr. Evers? Is it the Louisiana Purchase?
That is correct.
Yeah. If you'd be so kind, you want to touch on that there?
Sure. Be glad to. So anyways, what we have is, where is it? I have it. I had it. Oh, here it is. Yeah, I know. We're having a ball here. What we're doing tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is going live. It's the first time that Martin has been returned to us for a number of years. And we will be getting some more practice on this, I'm sure, over the next few days. So we're talking this evening about the Louisiana Purchase, and John is going to be sharing with us some very unusual characteristics about that Louisiana Purchase, how it's different from other types of law that we have. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn the call over to Brother John.
An honor and privilege. Thank you for your kind introduction, Michael and Martin. The Louisiana Purchase, which took place in 1803, we purchased it from Spain. But the thing that most people don't realize is that we purchased it from France. But the thing most people don't realize is that it was originally, surveyed, was French territory from 1699 for 63 years until 1762, when it was ceded to Spain. And then for 38 years until 1800, Napoleon regained ownership of what we now call the Louisiana Territory. Now, Louisiana Territory, for those of you who haven't had the benefit of any personal search or research in this area, encompasses quite a few areas and territories that include Arkansas, Iowa, Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, Nebraska, Minnesota, Louisiana, New Mexico, Texas, North and South Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, Colorado, and some portions of Canada, Alberta, and Saskatchewan. But the thing that's very, very curious is that while the French did give some land grants in the Louisiana Purchase, the area that was known as the Louisiana Purchase, and if you were to pretend that you were lighting a smoky fire and that the ground was the area around the Mississippi Delta, New Orleans, and the smoke was rising just a little bit to the left, you would see something that looks like a plume of smoke that would rise up and encompass and cover a large portion of the central and west central United States, all the way up into reaching into Canada. The thing that was so important about the Louisiana Purchase was that President was so preoccupied with the possibility of getting the Mississippi River to be able to accomplish the trade issues was so important that Thomas Jefferson tasked James Monroe and Robert Livingston with actually purchasing Norling, or as the folks in the South province pronounce it, Nolens. And they were negotiating with Francois Barbe Marthurier, and they quickly agreed to purchase it slightly after it was offered. Napoleon, suffering losses that in Haiti that was very, very great, and the fact that he was hanging on to this parcel to help in his defense against Spain, was using it as a pawn. In the meantime, there were many French land grants, however small they were, or larger or they were, that salt and peppered the Louisiana Purchase. However, in the year 1762, it was ceded to Spain. And what happened was that until 1800, Spain wanted to establish its foothold, and the whole west side of the Mississippi, they were issuing land grants in an effort to establish their territory. And back then, the United States on the east side of the Mississippi, they were trying to establish a foothold from with which they could defend all of their territories. And remember, back then, the old Republic of California and Texas and all these others were still part of the Spanish-held territories at those times. And so what happened was that Spain looked at this as a demarcation, a line in the sand, as it were. The thing that's very important is that to do that, they gave land grants with liberality to encourage individuals to populate this. Now, as part of that liberality, in spite of that liberality, at the time in 1803 when the United States purchased the Louisiana for $15 million, slightly less than $4 a square mile, or 4 cents an acre, did I mention that it was just pennies on the acre? Well, I should probably mention it was only pennies on the acre, that the only greater purchase than this would be Seward's Folly in 1959. But what happened was that the purchase, while they technically purchased the whole property back, all of the land grants that were given as part of the Enablement Act that bought the Louisiana Purchase into the United States, so that the United States sovereignty could cross the Mississippi River, and it almost doubled the nominal size of the country. There was about 15% of it that was in Canadian provinces, that of the Louisiana Purchase, which we eventually gave them. But over half of the around 60,000 inhabitants were enslaved Africans, and the western borders of the Purchase were settled by the 1819 Adams-Otis Treaty with Spain, where the northern borders of the Purchase were adjusted to the Treaty of 1818 with Britain. And what happened was that we still were dealing with Spain on this all the way up into the mid-late 1800s in certain cases, their claims evaporated. Now, what's important at this is that almost all of these land grants, including, of all things, the British land grants to the north, gave sovereignty to the property owner, which included the feudal practice of the property owner being the land owner being the highest taxing authority in that jurisdiction. This was very, very important for the crowns of not just Great Britain, but of France and Spain, because France, Napoleon really wanted and needed that economic support base of that property that was later known as Louisiana Purchase to help support his war effort and pay for the battle. Now, as the war efforts began to have challenges, Napoleon he ran into a little bit of challenges when he was in the Caribbean there, and what happened was that our president, you know, back then Thomas Jefferson, kind of invoked a policy of non-intervention and not picking sides. But what happened was that he also allowed Napoleon's forces to suffer a little bit of difficulty in rebuilding their New World Empire, and allowed even some contraband to the freedom fighters in the Caribbean and Haiti specifically, so that what happened was that they it was such a shame that these freedom fighters turned out to be able to have an uprising to he couldn't afford to do the battle there, which strategically kept him from coming back to reclaim or attempt to reclaim the Louisiana Purchase or any portion of their thereof it. Now, the land grants, and there are some of them that are sporadic and salt and peppered through the purchase, even though the purchase was made by the U.S., the land grants were still recognized in the Enablement Act that brought Louisiana into the Union. Now, one of the difficulties about purchasing large pieces of property is that the U.S. government can't hang on to them. They're not allowed to. The U.S. government, the government itself, 10 square miles, District of Columbia, Washington, D.C., is all, and the land that that might be purchased for arsenals, et cetera, and military bases and forts is all that they're technically allowed to own. And back then, our government was acting fairly honorably, I'll say fairly honorably, for the Constitution. So what was happening is that they were quick to sell off the property, and amidst that, many of them realized that they needed a tax base, and so a lot of the properties as they were sold off, they were those purchasing them that were establishing cities and encouraged commerce, and like the port that we now call New Orleans or New Orleans, was most of that was all encumbered with the ability to be for the property to be taxed. It was contracted away by the then rightful owner. Now, because it was contracted away by the then rightful owner, and not all of New Orleans or New Orleans suffers that that disability. We have one of the individuals, in fact, there's one on the call tonight that is in personal possession of an please forgive me, of one of the original land grants that that was put in place by then President James Buchanan in the 1859. James Buchanan was president from 1857 to 1862, but on July 1st of 1859, James Buchanan made a grant to this family, and that grant was part of a larger land grant that the general land offices of the United of the back then the Attorney General was the issue of what was needed with the original Spanish land grant still carried through to the individual land grant. And there's many of these small parcels that have this carrying through. Now, what's very important is that when an individual is looking at one of these parcels, it's the issue is that a portion of the rights or appurtenances can be contracted, and I'll use that word because one of your constitutional rights is the right to contract. Now, you're bound by that, and there are some things that you cannot contract away. Inalienable rights. They cannot be contracted away. Some people say, well, a lot of the slaves that were bought to America were under contract. Well, yes and no. But most of the contracts were the fact that those individuals, in over 92% of the cases of the slaves, were kidnapped, hijacked, or shanghaied, and sold to slave traders, of which they were part of the 41% of that slave trade came to the U.S. Now, those slaves, some of them claim bitterly about their slavery and the fact that they had to, you know, go through what they did. However, if they remained where they were, many of them would still be in not just medieval villages, but very humble accommodations to this day. I had somebody that he was the fourth generation that I met him just before he passed away 2 years ago. He was fourth generation in the States. His great great grandfather was kidnapped and bought over, and his great great grandfather, before he passed away when he was a child, explained to him what had happened, how his own village people came in the middle of the night, separated him from his wife and three children, bound him, gagged him, and put something akin to an animal skin over his head, blindfolded, and stacked him up in a pile of other human beings. When the slave traders got there, they were let off without being allowed to see where they were going until they were on the boat. When they were downstairs in the hold, then their blindfolds were allowed to be removed. And he said that except for the fact that his wife and three children were left behind, he later found out that they were killed from another slave who had come over 2 years after he did. But they were killed in a tribal battle. In fact, everyone in that village was killed in a tribal battle. He considered himself the fact that he was one of the first people in his lineage to get an education and came to the States and praised the fact that he was kidnapped, sold as a slave, and bought to America. And he said he could have gone to many other countries where it was abominably cruel. He worked in a cotton plantation in the South, and was later, that family was given a land grant in the Louisiana Territory. And he said that he lived, in his mind, better than the kings or the leaders of the tribal villages did in the original country. He remarried, had 11 children, and they all ended up free under the Emancipation Proclamation, and all went to school, got educations. Two of them were doctors. That was the grandfather of the gentleman that I spoke with. And they look at the fact that they were kidnapped, tortured, stolen away, shanghaied in the middle of the night, Some of them lost everything, including their families, like him. They consider the fact that they came, that they were sold to someone in the U.S., the most wonderful thing that could have possibly happened to them, and they consider being kidnapped a godsend. But what happened was is that his grandfather, as a free man, was given a parcel by back then the plantation owner who voluntarily freed all of his slaves, gave them parcels that were part of a Spanish land grant that in this case took place shockingly in 1784. It was part of a land grant that the Spanish gave an individual in 1784. It was later subdivided. They didn't come into it till 1854 is when he was given 640 acres, 1 mile square, along with every one of the other slaves when his plantation owner freed him. Individuals tried to tax them and tax the property. It turns out the plantation owner died in a defending their rights against the taxation. And to this day, that family, the descendants, enjoy a property tax-free environment. When I met the gentleman, he had an interesting light to share. And he pointed out something that I was not aware of, that almost 8% of the Louisiana Purchase was involved in some form or another of a Spanish land grant. 3% were involved in of the property was British land grants, and 12% in French land grants. And but that when the fact that at the point at which with this came into the Union in 1803, over half the inhabitants of the 60,000 inhabitants were slaves. By encouraging these plantation owners to move west, come west, they were populating and occupying the property, and much of it by donation or gift, some of it by purchase. But because the U.S. government back then could not keep the property, much of it was being given away, and to encourage one thing was that to encourage the railroad to begin to move west, they were given very substantial land grants for the purpose of laying track. And because it was a private entity, it wasn't governed or owned, they were allowed to do that with liberality. Later, when in the 1900s, when some of the railroads would come under financial duress in the early 1900s, around the, shall we say, the late 20s, early 30s, if anybody remembers how, everybody remembers the Roaring 20s, but it seems like, you know, the dubious nom de guerre of the stock market crash of 1929 laid kind of a little bit of a black mark on that. And after that, many of the railroads that began to suffer financial trauma began to sell off some of the parcels. They were selling off sections 1 mile square from around the track easements without selling off the easements. And to that end, what transpired was that some of these pickled over and tripped over some of the original land grants that still had the rights and appurtenances of no taxation. At one juncture, about 40 years ago, at a hearing in state of California in Superior Court in Southern California, Los Angeles, I met someone who was also had been his parents had been, grandparents had been slaves, pointed out that they had purchased from the railroad for a dollar an acre, which was very expensive back then, one section square for $640. And that was a very expensive parcel for them at the time. But turns out that his grandparents didn't consider that extremely expensive because it was non. They found out after they purchased it, the railroad wasn't clear on the original land grant that they were immune from property tax because they were the highest taxing authority. What happens is that well-meaning individuals and have attempted to burden property with the purpose of taxation for the purpose of promoting commerce and social development, cities or towns, as you will. And the moment you have a city or a town, the moment, you know, you've got to have a way to keep the peace. So back then, for every county in the United States, there's a sheriff. And right now, out of the 3,143 counties in the United States, there's a handful of them that they have no population, and so those what's happening? There's one in Hawaii. There's a county called Loving County in Texas. There's King County in Texas, and there's Kennedy County in Texas. And but there's a bunch of these that that have no zero population. But to support that population, what happened is that they had to have a way to keep the peace. And so for every county, you also have a sheriff. So what happens is that in the issue about who's the big guy in town, what happens is that you find that a number of counties in the U.S. And the number of sheriffs is exactly equal. The sheriff is the highest law enforcement authority in the county. There was a difficulty many years back. I remember listening to a mayor in California have an argument with the sheriff. It was one of the South geographical locales, and we were there for the difficulty that some of the sheriff deputies we had pointed out that they were illegally seizing the firearms of individuals that had been convicted of a felony. And the question we asked him was, where in the Constitution does when somebody commits a felony that their inalienable rights become are alienated from them? And the sheriff says he's going to support that. The mayor says you're fired. The sheriff stood up, walked around the table, leaned over at the mayor and looked him in the eye and says, I'm an elected official just like you. Should I arrest you for deprivation of civil rights under color of law? You don't have the authority to fire me. You can fire your crony, the police chief, but you can't fire me. And if you say that again, I will have you arrested on criminal charges, and I've got a stack. The mayor was very quiet after that. The two officers that he also left them alone because they had a new policy that anyone who had a a criminal violation of certain stature on their record, was not allowed to possess a firearm in San Diego County. That went away very quietly at the time. Since that was many, many years ago, since then it's come up again in an unbelievably unpleasant manner. But what happens is that to promote safety and security, we have to be able to pay that sheriff, don't we? We also, if we're going to have any kind of township, we're going to have a mayor, we've got to cover his expenses also. Some of the townships were, they had some commerce and they had some other ways to cover the salaries of the immediate elected officials. Most of them couldn't, so they turned to taxation. And, taxing by property was the way they handled it. It's nice when you can afford a police force that has all the latest electronic wizardry, gadget, doohickey, bob, shoestring, push log, monkey motion. It'll fly around this side and shoot the bad guy from the back, you know, kind of technology and all this other stuff. But where is that coming from? And granted, at one point or another, I may have worked in a technology environment, in a technology sector, and I may have even worked for the government, you know, for government contractors or such. And, you know, and there's a point with which you can, with like a defense contractor, you can just keep throwing money at the wall and that thing just keeps getting better and better and better. And people say, wow, but look at the price tag. When does reality strike and you have to decide, what kind of check your mouth can write? And whether your butt can cash, I mean, your constituency and the population of your county can cash that. And what's happened is that some of them well-meaning, but however noble these sentiments, have passed spending and funding bills for the government. And they said somebody came to them with technology that, you know, if we just develop this, then we'll have the advantage over the old mutually assured destruction policy for the world. And so what happens is that taxation begins to run amok. There comes a point with which if individuals are allowed to spend without constraint, they will write checks there, but I mean their constituency can't cash. And what happens is that it all ends up on the backs and the shoulders of the people. And others that are in favor of the taxation will say, well, look at the public sidewalks we have around the park in the center square of the town. You know, a sprawling metropolis of 2073. You know, there's a little town, central east, Texas that last time I was there, that was the population, and the people, they groaned about putting sidewalks in that center square and the park. They didn't want the taxation. In fact, they voted it down. They even voted not one but two mayors out of office and five other council persons, two of them were ladies. And then what they ended up doing was just taking up a collection, public donations, and unbelievably, the people came up with almost two-thirds of the money to do not just the sidewalks in the center square, but sidewalks all around the outside and put curbs on the streets and pave the center square of that little town. As it turns out, there was a gentleman who was not doing too badly that had a little manufacturing facility in there that manufactured parts and such and materials for Honeywell, for radar, and what would later be GPS satellites that were part of what was integrated by Hughes Satellite and Missile Systems out of El Segundo, California. They donated the other third out of the goodness of their heart. I found out that when we stopped for lunch at, of all things, a Dairy Queen in that little town, they were so proud of their park. The people were bringing their own lawnmowers to keep the lawn mowed. That was probably the most well-kept little park that I've ever seen in my life. They were very, very proud of it. The Dairy Queen owner was very proud that he had donated $4,500 to that and 6 days of labor. And I said, 6 days of labor? He says, I would have closed the Dairy Queen when I went over there to work and help dig out and lay the rebar and everything else. But as it turned out, everybody had to eat. So I had to keep my restaurant open. This little town, that changed the face forever and how well they get along. I later learned that just outside that little town is part of a land grant, Spanish land grant, that was non-taxable. That gentleman who did the contracting that later was serving the defense contractors, he was part and parcel right dead in the middle of where that Spanish land grant was. And to that end, when it comes time to purchase a piece of property, there are some friends that that I met at a seminar that Justice Breshears did in 1996. He came to Texas here and did actually, he was very nice. He did a couple here. We had him up here in 96 and 98 to do a couple of conferences, and we talked about titles in Elodium and some of the areas that had no taxation. And there's a chunk of the Ohio Valley that of all things was just unbelievably well situated, that was part of the original at this juncture, it was part of a French land grant, but they it was non-taxable, and four people from that seminar picked up stakes and moved from, two of them were living in Texas, one of them was Arkansas, and one was Oklahoma. They all went and bought property in the Ohio Valley, and that was non-taxable. One of them would later run into some financial difficulties in that there was three bad years with very little rain in where they were at. And his John Deere tractors, four huge combines, and a bunch of these 50-40 tractors that could pull a nine-bottom plow each. You know, there was, back then, that was significant. Now they got 13-bottom plows. But John Deere financing, through the bank, foreclosed on them. And the sheriff, at gunpoint, crossed into the property of this one individual, took those four combines and the six John Deere 5040s and an old 5010 accidentally. The farmer did not fight him, did not engage any threat. He knew the sheriff personally, and the sheriff says, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do about it. He says, yes, there is. And he explained to him, he says, look, if you can prove that up to me, we'll see if we can get your tractors back. And the attorney for John Deere financing was right there and says, no, there's not. And the bank said, there's no way you're getting them back. Well, what happened was that he proved that his territory was sovereign. They had no right to enter his territory, his land. And John Deere, wishing to evade and avoid arrest warrants that were already grand jury indictments with arrest warrants written, donated, not four combines, but six. And for the other tractors, doubled them and onto them with all the implements and complements. There's an old saying, you should know the truth and the truth shall set you free. By now you figured out that this is just the tip of a unbelievably huge iceberg. Some of you have probably heard about that iceberg that just broke off from the Antarctica that was more than a mile square. This iceberg is a lot bigger under the water. This is just the tip of it. From time to time, this subject topic will come up. We're slowly rounding off. We're going to try to round out your education so that you begin to see with the background of what the facts are, that you might, it might be thought provoking enough that you might, if you're ever consider moving, choose a little bit of research on the property that you're going to, next. My time has come to a close now, and I will tell you this, that presently we are working on the topic of inalienable rights, and in one of the future evening discussions will be allodial title or natural title. And to that end, we'll show you some of the research that Michael Edwards and myself and some of the others on these calls have been doing, and where we're going with it, in hopes to be able to establish an environment where you too can free yourself, even if you don't have can't trace title in allodium, to a non-taxable property situation, property tax situation, where it'll grant you the grace to be tax-free. With that, you are not required to maintain subject matter topic, or at we're all going to open it up for question and answer. And back to Michael Edwards. Thank you.
Well, Brother John, thank you very much. That was the most interesting and intriguing comment piece that you presented to us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, press star 2 on your keypad. Press star 2 to raise your hand on your keypad. And those of you on Freedom's Radio, you'll notice to the center right of your monitor a silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. It's empty. Left-click inside of it and type away your comment or your question. Underneath that rectangle, you'll see a place to put your name and also some other information if you like. And then hit submit. When you hit submit, it pops up on my end, and I will be glad to lend my voice to your comment or your question. So again, press star 2 on your keypad. That star is the that icon underneath the number 7 on your keypad. So we'll start with Anita, go with Ed, go with Brent, and have Kent. So we go with Anita first. Go ahead, Miss Anita.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me?
Perfect.
Good evening, precious, sweet Anita. Yes, it is good to hear your voice, girl.
Thank you.
You rock, girl.
All right. I listened to your talk and how you described once there's a city and a county or whatever, and they have this structure, political structure, they need money, as you described it. They need funds. So hypothetically, suppose everyone in their city or incorporated situation suddenly got their titles in allodium, got off the poverty tax rolls. So I'm just thinking of, as individuals, if we're off the poverty tax rolls, if everyone was off, what happened to that? How would the city fund their police, their fire, or whatever we think might be necessary?
You go, girl. You rock. That's a very good question. I'm glad you asked that. Presently, what's happened is that there are some places that have already had that challenge, Anita, and I'm glad you asked that. Here in Texas, back a few years, we had a little difficulty where there was a flood that not just covered a few streets, but also flooded our capital in Austin. And a very a gentleman who's a good and close friend who passed away recently, Don, he had the contract for draining the Capitol building. And if you ever know, any of you have ever been to Austin, Texas, you know the Capitol building has many floors below ground, and that much of the Capitol is recessed below the surface. And to that end, all of that was flooded. And the archives are below that, and the lowest portions of that. And so many of the documents that we were working with, we found out that, and they're drying. In fact, I still have one of the 20-ton air conditioners, diesel-powered, sitting less than 80 feet from me as I speak right now, that was used in that. We pumping cool dry in there to preserve the documents cool. And they needed to be dry and cool. And it was discovered that the Stephen F. Austin land grants, that most of those territories were technically tax-free. And as the information got out, it spread like wildfire. And a lot of individuals, the local taxing entities were, you know, going ballistic. They were trying to foreclose. They were taking the people. And much of the people's lands were, they closed on them. You know, they foreclosed on a tax lien. And what happened was is that the judiciary was so, so vexed by it, because you can't rule on it in favor of the taxes, because your constituency will, you know, at the very least, hang you in effigy. You can't rule against it, because at the very least, your fellow elected officials will hang you in effigy. So it's just all in how you choose you want to be hung and defamed. They wouldn't touch it. So what happened was, is on the 2000 ballot here in Texas, there came a referendum to forgive all of the individuals that had property tax arrears in the Austin and Grimes counties. And you can look this up still to this date. It's on the internet. Different portions of this keep disappearing. And bless their sweethearts, certain people keep putting it back up, you know, and it comes up. And At one point I watched for over 6 weeks in a row. The longest one lasted 3 days. They kept taking it down. For personal entertainment, I watched, you know, how quickly they would put it up and it would get taken down. But it's still out there. And some of them have now been up for quite a while. But what happened was is that, Anita, whole sections of the county were now destitute for taxes. And so what happened was is that for the property taxes, and that included not just the property tax, but the school taxes. And a few of the neighborhoods began that had homeschool networks bought three of the school buildings and converted them to private schools. And those private schools are doing very well. And there's a private school that was built called Regents. Actually, I shouldn't use names, but they excelled in unbelievable growth. In fact, we even had, I want to say 04, we had a competition with one of the private schools here in the Houston area, where the physics professors, and you say, John, was this college or university? No, this is elementary, junior high, and high school. And they were teaching physics, second and third year physics at these schools. And they had a competition for a student-powered hovercraft. And I still have pictures of the student-powered hovercraft that won, that was built here at a private school in Houston. But what happened was is that the quality of education shot right through the ceiling, because now everybody was privately funding it. And most of the ISD, the integrated school districts, all but collapsed, except for the federal funding that was coming in. And what happened was is that they started now the commercial businesses started carrying a larger portion of the load. They there was quite a few ways that they did generate taxes, and I call them townships. They're actually cities now, but they were townships then. Invested abroad, and is still making, the cities are making money hand over fist on foreign investments. They unbelievable. This one township even, at first they tried to build their own bank, but there was a conflict of interest in the city owning the bank. So private individuals took it over, but they began to find creative ways to replace the income. That's the type of creativity that's a necessity. By the way, it's coincidentally, you know, that little story I told about the town of 2073. A lot of these little cities of a quarter and a half a million have come to almost the same kind of camaraderie, fellowship. It says a brother's born of adversity. Well, Anita, these individuals that are in these little towns, that their children are now going to private schools. And I listened to one person say, she was just very candid, and she's on the school board for the private school. And they call it a homeschool board. And her words were, "Who do you think you are complaining about the school system when you remand your children to the state to be raised when you should be raising them yourself?" And I come to find out the parents all rotate and take turns teaching at all three of the schools in that township. And when the state tried to shut them down, the students were all tested, and every one of them tested no less than two grades above the grade that they were posted in. So, Anita, a brother's born of adversity, the fellowship that they came into, necessity is the mother of invention. They created new ways for funding, and necessity, she's the little old lady that lives around the corner down at the end of the block. And, an invention, the stuff that they invented was just unbelievable. I have no idea how that could be implemented in a state, that like New York, where, sometimes you have a population density, of 3 people per square foot in some of those blocks, and that's per square foot of ground, meaning that, you know, when you have a 20-story or 60-story condominium, you know, the ground, you know, you can have 3 persons per square foot of used over ground. Does that help at all, Anita?
Yes. It kept coming. When there's a will, there's a way. But here we have volunteer fire departments, so they still need money. But I was told most of the taxes, someone told me, I don't know if it's true, most of the property taxes go to fund the police department. I'm not sure what but.
In your neighborhood?
Yeah, in my county.
You're part of town. Wow. Now, by the way, back in the 70s and early 80s, I worked as a part-time EMT paramedic for Santa Fe Springs Volunteer Fire Department in Southern California. I donated my time. And up until 3 years ago, where I live now, they had a Spring Volunteer Fire Department. They started an ESD, an Emergency Services District, with a tax base authority to improve the quality of the equipment and everything else. The bad joke, the pun is that The service has depreciated 25% to 30% since the implementation of tax-funded firefighting. And here, like when I was a volunteer firefighter, you know, or EMT paramedic back in the 70s, and I only used to work a couple days a week, and I worked graveyard. Graveyard and swing weren't paid shifts. The day shift was the only shift that was paid back then. Well, the same thing was here up until a few years ago. When that alarm goes off, but the zeal and the pride amongst those individuals that was stripped and castrated from them and emasculated from them when it became a paid organization, caused the quality of service to plummet drastically. And I kid you not, I've got people that can testify to that, that are willing to volunteer and tell you how bad it is now that it's a tax-funded emergency service district. But you go, girl. You got VFD there.
All right. Anita, yeah. Any other questions?
Okay, thank you.
All right. I will say that here in Florida, the greatest gobbler of property taxes is the school board. Anyways, just saying. Next is Ed. Come on, Ed. What's up?
It's the school board here too.
Right.
What part of town do you hang your hat in, Ed?
I'm in western Pennsylvania. In the Ohio Valley, actually.
Sick 'em doggy. I have family that live in western Pennsylvania.
Correct.
Only a few miles from Horseshoe Bend and some in, you ever heard of a little town called Summerhill?
I might get that mixed up with some stuff that's in movies, but I know where Horseshoe Bend is.
Yep. Got friends that live, got family. My brother's wife's family lives only a few miles from Horseshoe Bend, and her parents were there during that. They actually went out to help during that accident.
That's a little further away. I'm right on the border with Ohio.
Oh, okay. Well, your question is, Ed?
A question? Well, not just a question. But a comment too. Did I hear you say that there's some of you that are discussing, like there's a given night of a week dedicated to discussing allodial titles and stuff of that general mindset?
Well, There are some of us that get together and cuss and discuss titles and et cetera. We do it kind of on an ad hoc basis because we don't have the time allocated to do that. Our present workload is such that I try to set aside one out of every four classes to deal with either allodial title, land grants, property tax, etc. That is such a big subject. And Michael Edwards felt that this was one of the topics that knowing the history of where we came from helps us look forward to, especially when we're trying to restore liberty in America. And so because of his because of his perspectives and the value of it, we try to cover some of this at least once a month. Sometimes it's not possible, sometimes it's very possible. There's a handful of subjects that we try to cover that also include world banking, et cetera, sovereignty. Well, I hate that word sovereignty. It's gotten so badly abused. So many people have misused it. But the thing is that it really is sovereignty, but the people who don't really know what they're talking about throw it around. It gets used in court. It gets integrated into a brief, and because they don't know how to defend it, they get ruled against. And so what's happened is that because they didn't properly commit themselves to education, it cost them what little, may have cost them what little sovereignty they had, and in certain cases it cost them their liberty. We try to do our best to cover as much of the different topics as possible. This is one of them.
Yeah, well, you got me all excited. I had another question too, and I can't even think of what it was. I have a set of talks on my, well, I guess it's probably from 4 or 5 computers ago, and they're by a guy named Wilbur. I can't remember his full name, but they're on Landsat. Each one's an hour-long talk, and it's a discussion. People ask him questions, and he's really quite good. And I listened. I went through about half of them at one time, and then it moved on. He gives talks by section of the country, and like there's allodial titles, as it would be allodial titles, I'm not sure of the term, but out west that go clear back to land grants from Spain, and they carried over into the U.S. And needless to say, they didn't stipulate any controls on water. And the people out there who are knowledgeable about what land they have, whether it's connected to one of those grants, and even connected to a U.S. grant of land that was pre-1876, I believe, and that's when the U.S. made the first Water Act. The U.S. has no control over the say of how they use water, where if they grant land after 1876, there are stipulations on the grant, it's sort of like a contract, that says about preserving water, where they can only use a certain amount of water from a stream or whatever. But it is really, really interesting. And I only own what my father, Heavenly Father, gave me here, an acre and a third, and I am always at risk on property taxes. And I can raise enough food here and then make enough money otherwise to buy the rest of it, that I don't really have to leave here, so long as I can buy electricity too. I don't know how to deal with life without electricity yet. That gets tough. But when you add taxes into it, property taxes, suddenly you got to go out of your way to get money to pay a government so you can live. And it really does come down to paying a government so you can live. And that's certainly a recognition that the government is chief sovereign, but also chief slaveholder. Because if you owe someone else anything on your life, you're a slave. You're not free. And there's no part of your life that another man should own. If the government's going to exist, it should exist on, like, taxing bicycle tires or cartwheels. But there's court cases, early history, about whether the government should have a right to tax wheels on carts.
Do you remember how the government was originally funded?
Do I remember how it was funded?
On import and export taxes.
Imports and exports, right.
Yep. We need to go back to that.
Yeah.
Tariffs. at trade tariffs.
Yeah.
And the thing that the mall. Now, let me ask you a question. If a government is funding off of trade tariffs, import and export, then the cost of goods coming in, and a lot of those taxes is being paid by who?
Right.
Other countries, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well. So we're not necessarily, making all the money off the backs and the sweat of the brow of our own people, are we?
There are four constitutional taxes that we have that we're subject to. We're subject to a national tax as apportioned. Okay? Every head pays the same amount, rich or poor. And the rest is three others is excise. Excise taxes are like taxes on fuel when you purchase fuel and things like that. That's perfectly lawful. Excise tax, imposts, and tariffs. That's it. And our country ran for 100 years perfectly well with just that.
And those direct taxes are supposed to only last. They're levied by issue.
Mm-hmm.
Particular issue. They're to fund a particular issue.
Right.
You know, if foreign countries and foreign industrials are paying part of the tax, paying the taxes, and paying part of the government's ticket and funding it, then the cost of those goods, et cetera, and services that they offer from abroad, they have to raise those prices, don't they? And to that end, doesn't just level the playing field for the domestic laborer or shopkeeper or factory owner or factory worker, but gives them an advantage, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Your government is working for you.
Okay.
Ed, I appreciate
you.
So, Michael, help me out here. What was I trying to remember? You and I were discussing earlier.
I've been sitting here trying to remember that myself. Sorry.
Yeah, we're both.
I forgot I had a bad.
If it comes, yeah, I forgot you had a bad memory. If it comes to you, Ed, just raise your hand again, okay? All right. Next is Brent. Go ahead, Brent.
Yeah. Hi. Good evening.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Brent.
John, I don't know if you're. I know that you're super busy, and I certainly don't want to. This is just a question for this call. This is not asking you to do anything. I know you're working on it. I had, based on prior calls and information that you've provided, I put together a letter giving notice to the IRS that my status has changed and trying to head off at the pass because I have not filed since I changed my status. And sooner or later, it's going to catch up to me and they're going to be looking for something.
Knocking on your door.
Yeah. And I'd rather just kind of.
You did forward that to me, you did forward it to me like 3 weeks ago or so, 2 weeks ago. Yeah, okay. I've already forwarded that to John. Yeah, okay.
Sure. I know you're so busy, you probably haven't looked at it, but what I gather is that you have a different approach than what I did in the letter. I was pretty much straight to the point. I've changed my status. I'm not going to be filing. Please refund my money from the last 3 to 3 years kind of thing. You mentioned, you alluded to some sort of question approach that you do. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, that's a good question. Would you like an answer?
Yes, I would.
Good question. Glad you asked. Asking the IRS thought-provoking questions that raise issues in their mind that when they realize they can't answer the question creates an environment where you have two options for the Treasury Department. One, they can either answer your question by saying you're right, there isn't, you're not required to pay taxes, or there can be an absence of evidence and an absence of response with which now we have to escalate it a little bit, and now we ask a jurist or even a jury to say, hey, look, guys, you know, they're claiming we owe them. We have covered this many times for a long period of time, and they haven't come up with any answers. Right now, we would like to make a motion for temporary injunction and permanent restraining order because of the harassment and the terrorization and the continual threats on our person, meaning that they're talking about that if it's not legal or lawful or lawfully required, then an arrest is kidnapping under color of law, and which is a federal felony and a capital crime. And so we would like to make a motion for temporary injunction and permanent restraining order against the Treasury Department, against them ever demanding that we file a 1040 ever again. There you okay. are.
What that's when you get to the court level, but what about the questions that you ask them?
Well, that's a good question. It depends on each individual situation. Most of them that we've been dealing with the fact that they've received fan mail, and so it takes on a whole host of directions and questions, and it's based on the individuals. Now, I'm assuming that you probably may have gotten some fan mail from these overly thoughtful citizens. Have you?
No, I don't have any fan mail.
Okay.
I want to head that off.
Okay. Okay. Okay, there's a whole approach to that, and I would need about a minimum of an hour and a half to cover that with you. And I need to know which taxing entities, whether you're also dealing with a state entity at the same time.
Yes.
See, which state do you live in? Or which
Arizona.
State do you hang your hat? Okay. Yeah, because there's many states that do not have a state income tax, you know. And so what's happening is that, you'll need to have a, we're way too late to even start on it tonight. And I need a little bit of your background so that I know which path you need to go on so I can answer your question properly. And Arizona is one of those ones that right now you can get up to almost 3% on the taxation in Arizona. It goes between 2.5 and 3. Can you get a hold of Michael and see if we can make an appointment for a conference call and just have a chat, and I'll see if I can answer some of those questions for you, because I need your feedback. That is a big question.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. Do you have any other questions?
No, that's it for, well, that, yeah, that's it for tonight.
Okay. You've been keeping up with all the other questions that have been going on?
Yeah, as far as the Lodial title stuff.
Yeah, okay, good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. I need to find out which land grant this property is in, if it is in one at some point. But
right. And that
obviously.
Yeah.
That's
and,
research. That's not a question for you.
Yeah, that's we can get you started on guiding you through some search and some research on that one. Okay, is there anything else I can do to be an asset or a blessing for you, Brent?
You are a blessing. God bless you. Thank you so much.
Thank
All
you
right,
for your
next
kind
is
words.
Kent. Go ahead, Kent.
Good evening, gentlemen. Thank you. Thank you, John, for both an interesting and an important call. I appreciate that. I want to make a statement about something Anita was talking about regarding the taxes. I had a friend who passed away about a year ago, give or take, and he was telling me he lived in Rockland County, New York, which stretches, I guess, from around Sloatsburg or Suffern over New City, New York. And he was telling me that the Hasidic Jews were taking statutory exemptions on their property taxes, paving over their front yards to make their house a religious facility, and they were driving everybody else's taxes up. And that, at least temporarily, was the net result of so many people in that county in New York taking those tax deductions. Where it's gone since then, I don't know. I haven't followed it. I have a couple of questions, or several questions, actually. You were talking about land grants and places that land grants were subverted by taxation. Do you see any situations today where one may not be able to go back to the original land grant and make that property or take that property off the tax rolls because somehow legally and or lawfully it was subverted along the way to some taxation process?
Well, that's a very good question, and it has a very good answer. When you trace title back to the land grant, and you establish a lodium, it meaning you've traced it back to the original title, and the original title allows you to occupy or own that, and that makes the owner the highest taxing authority, unless a previous owner to you has legitimately and legally contracted that away. If somebody has usurped it, as you so carefully pointed out, and thank you, that's a good word, you can get a court order to have that reversed.
Unless they contracted it away.
Well, if they contracted away, then it's not there to be had.
So let me use an example. I don't know whether you're familiar or not. I brought this up on a prior call. I think it was with another speaker, though. If you look at the Catawba Indian tribe down around Fort Mill in Rock Hill, South Carolina, just directly below Charlotte, North Carolina, back in the 80s and 90s, they decided that a lot of their land in that area was taken. They were not justly compensated for it, and they wanted it back. Now, they built a lot of million-dollar homes in that area and a lot of other commercial industry, et cetera, and the title insurance companies were in an uproar, et cetera, about what would happen if they ever succeeded with their claim in the federal court system. So what really ended up happening is pragmatically was that the state bought them out, gave them a lot of money, built them a nice town hall on their Indian reservations, et cetera, and they signed up for license plates, driver's licenses, 1040 forms, et cetera, unbeknownst. I don't really think they knew what the whole deal was when they did it. Now, would that be an example? Now, I know you probably don't know all the facts surrounding this, but would that be an example that you're talking about wherein someone could have contracted the rights away previously, and on any of those properties where they were bought off so the Indians could no longer make a claim to that property, that those people would not be able to take those property off of the tax rolls, or is that a far stretch on my part?
And
we're talking about
this, also figure into this, John, rescission of signature. Go ahead.
Yeah. The you're talking about the lawsuits, that whole batch of lawsuits that the Ouachita Nation filed. Is that the ones you're talking about?
Well, these were the Catawba Indians. I don't know that it was the Ouachita Nation. I mean, I think there's been several instances around the country where something similar has happened. The Catawba Indian tribe is not a well-known tribe. It wasn't a big tribe. I don't know what they were a part of.
The tribal elders, that in certain Indian structures have unconditional and unimpeachable authority to speak for the whole tribe. They could contract away those rights. Many of the tribes convey that authority to the elders.
Well, it was my understanding, I talked to the deputy chief one-on-one in his office, and it was my understanding at the time that his daughter was one of the tribal attorneys, and the tribal attorneys took care of all of this and negotiated with the state. He claimed that they really didn't know all the ramifications of what they were signing into with license plates, driver's licenses, 1040 forms, both state and federal, et cetera. So I don't know. I never talked to the daughter directly. That meeting was never was able to arrange it. So, but they, he
is a contract. Let me ask you a question real quick. Can I interrupt?
Yeah.
Is a contract valid if you are not propounded with all the terms of the contract in advance?
Of course not. But again, you know, okay. I don't have all of this in writing or as fact, so I'm just basically asking a general question, and I'm not trying to be foolish about it, not having all the facts, but, you know, you were bringing up the issue about did somebody contract something away, and using the example you used, and I'm asking in this way, could the tribal attorneys contract everybody else's rights away that owns property in the area by them settling with both state and federal government?
Only if he or she had the authority to, and in certain cases, that would have required consent of everyone. There are some cases where everyone in the tribe would have had to, that was living, would have had to agree to that. Because the dissenting member, in certain tribal hierarchies, it requires unanimity. Meaning that you must have a unanimous vote. There cannot be a single dissenter. And that's something I've learned about tribal law. You probably heard of somebody called Iron Eyes Cody years ago. He lived in the town that I lived in that I grew up for over 10 years of my life. And he explained to me quite a bit about tribal law. And one of the things was that he was so glad to get out of the leadership of his tribe because of the fact that he could never get a unanimous vote to be successful on anything because in his tribe, everything had to absolutely be unanimous. And if that's one of those cases there, and she cannot contract all that away legitimately.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess there's a lot of questions that remain. The people in the area that were affected, and of course there were probably, you know, thousands of them that owned, you know, pieces of property in the area, they really never said much because they depended on the state basically to buy the Indian tribe off and just keep their land. Of course, if they knew then what we know today about the property tax rolls and all, it would have been beneficial if some of those people had spoken up. But to my knowledge, nobody really spoke up. They just wanted to buy the Indians off and get them out of there, period.
They didn't speak up because they didn't know they needed to, which means that they did not understand the gravity of the contract, and that means that all the terms and conditions were not propounded to them, doesn't it?
That would sound like it's probably the fact. So let me
go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask. The question I ask is that, okay, having just reviewed that, does that constitute justiciable standing to address the matter on that specific issue?
I would guess that it would.
Imagine that. Next question.
Okay. So a number of years ago, probably about 15 or 20, I was familiar with a gentleman named Dennis Craig in Indiana who was had researched some of the national forests, et cetera, and he claimed, and I'm going to direct this to what you said before about when our government once had integrity and they didn't try to own large parcels of land, they sold it off gave it to people. He claimed in his research, unfortunately he died in jail, but he claimed in his research that the U.S. was claiming, or the U.S. government was claiming certain lands and certain areas in the Smoky Mountains that they really rightfully could not hold or make a claim to. Now, he never brought this totally to fruition. Do you see that based on your statement before about, well, when the government had integrity, they didn't hold on to these large parcels? Do you see situations today that you could possibly name wherein the government is holding large parcels in their name or some alphabet agency name that they have no right to hold and cannot constitutionally hold?
You mean the U.S. Department of the Interior or the U.S. Forestry Department? Are those ones you're
yeah.
talking about?
Those two as an example, but I could imagine.
Or the BLM.
Yeah. Or I imagine there could be other alphabet agencies.
Imagine that.
I guess the answer's in the affirmative. I guess the answer's in the affirmative.
Well, there. Can I offer a small clarification for your benefit?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay. The aggregate entity in the government of the United States of America that was given the 10 miles square of District of Columbia, Washington, D.C., and the right to own arsenals, magazines, forts, and military bases as necessary as they could purchase. Is that the same entity as the corporation, all caps United, all caps States, all caps of, all caps America, that was created?
Do you want me to answer that?
Yes, please.
No.
Okay. So, that's interesting. Well, all of these other individuals are acting under the corporation, aren't they?
That is correct.
They're not acting under the aggregate government. Okay. Now, here's where a penny drops. There was a case, U.S. District Court case. This particular one was in Central California, where the judge says, I'm sorry, but the government has the right to own as much land as it needs to. And he says, we're going to rule against you. And the objection, Your Honor, 10 miles square, this particular island has 146 square miles that they're trying to take from the defendant. And I'm sorry, it's just now are you saying that there is a way that the government has subverted what was defined in the Constitution and is not operating under the constitutional law? But you don't understand, there's a corporation. Are you saying that there was such an uproar in the courtroom that the judge overturned his decision right in front of everybody, demanded that the clerk rewrite the order to match his overturning of it, and he took off his gown just outside the door and resigned?
Mm-hmm. How long ago was that?
1979.
Mm-hmm. 40 years ago.
Yeah. Yes, that's correct. That was up in Santa Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
That if you ask the right question, so that it becomes thought-provoking, so they realize the error. Some of them, I don't know why he resigned so quickly, so immediately. He did have enough tenure that he had a very satisfactory retirement coming. But he moved out of the country and was gone in 42 days. In 42 days, he had sold all of his assets and moved offshore. I found out more than 10 years later that he moved to a non-extradition country. Imagine that.
Gee.
But asking the right question, so that learning how to, that old saying, you should know the truth and the truth shall set you free. The father, the son, you know, I believe in this unconditionally, in this intelligent designer guy out there, and however everybody wants to refer to him, ET, space aliens, God, Yahweh, you know, spirits, go, you know, whatever. He's out there. And that's all there's to it. And that, there was this young man, this kid that claimed he was either God or the son of God, and he came with some pretty phenomenal credentials. He raised the dead, he healed the sick, the lame walked, and the blind saw, and he even, allegedly raised himself from the dead. Now, you can fool some of the people all the time, and you can fool all the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. But everybody was there. Some of them were tortured to death, and usually there's two things that most people don't enjoy, blood and pain, especially their own. And, you know, when an individual is lying, liars have very thin integrity. And when it comes to the thickness of their skin, their tolerance for pain is even less. And they usually change their tune very quickly when there's any kind of threat to their person. Not one of those witnesses that saw this young kid raise himself from the dead, let alone the ones that he raised previously, or the lame walk, the blind saw, you know, and the hearing ears, deaf ears hear. Not one of them changed their story, their tune, and that kid said that, don't worry about what you will say in that day, for I will give you the words to say. And if a person is commissioned their heart onto the Most High King, and some people say, well, I don't know how complicated, this sounds awful complicated, and there's a lot of religious mumbo-jumbo. Yeah, but in Romans, in the book of the Romans, chapter 10, verse 9 and 10, it's all there, that if you confess to your lips that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart he died for your sins, you shall be saved. With your mouth you confess you're forgiven, and your heart you believe you're saved. All the other options, free, free, free. Everything else is icing. But that is what makes an individual the difference between me, a low-down, slimy, scum-sucking, bottom-feeding, swamp moss sinner, and a low-down, slimy, scum-sucking, bottom-feeding, swamp moss sinner redeemed by unmerited favor, by the kindness of the Most High King. That's what makes the difference between those two people, me before, me now. And if you ask for his help, he'll do the same thing he's done for me so many times, where he's honored me with the right question to ask at the right time. And, you know, this battle that we're raging against has been going on for not just weeks or months, not just years or generations, but millennia. And it's the battle over men's souls. And this battle, when compared to eternity, it doesn't last very long. If we were to say that a man lived 100 years and recorded history to date is just over 6,000, that if we said everybody lived 100 years, that's 1/60th of eternity. If we were to say eternity was only 6,000 years, what that means is that there's 24 hours in a day, and you live in 1/60th of eternity, you live 24 minutes. If a day is compared to eternity, now can you put up with somebody mistreating you, being unkind, rude, taking your property, slapping you around, cutting, you know, tying you up, cutting small, shallow and deep cuts in your different portions of skin, and pouring thoughtful solutions of lemon juice and acid, you know, and being called names and abused for 24 minutes at the beginning of the day, from 12:01 to 12:25, can you put up with 24 minutes so you can enjoy the other 23 hours and 36 minutes in absolute pure bliss and pleasure? Can you put up with 24 minutes of abuse?
Well, that's something that each man has to answer for himself.
Yep, Yep. It's some, well, I mean, I evaluated that, and I can put up with every, bring it on. They just, oh, ding, ding, ding. Bonus points. Okay. At the end of that 24 minutes, you get a new body. But,
well, I would say, the thing, I would, go ahead.
The thing that these people are dishing out, just know that it's very temporal. And our property, we're only the custodians of it for a short period of time. Unless you do what, Justice Breshears takes some of his paths so that when time transcends our lives, that now our lives transcend time and those that we leave behind still have what we worked really hard for. And if we do that very carefully, and if we risk ourselves from underneath the tyranny of that which would abuse us and take our liberty so that we're no longer slaves of a corporation, and then the properties that we have and that all this research and research that we're doing, if we take it to a place where it's now protected for the long term, and Justice Breshears has unbelievable ways to protect the assets that you and I so carefully struggle to acquire, and so that when the fullness of our days comes to pass and that intelligent designer decides our that he's about to punch our time card, you know that everything we work for just doesn't evaporate. It goes on.
I like your explanation, and I thank you for it. I would tend to look at this as a, you were saying it's a battle for souls, and it's been going on for generations. I would tend to look at it as a much larger war for the souls that has been going on for generations, and we're involved in today is simply one battle of many that have come before and many that will go after.
We fight not against flesh and blood, but against power, principalities, rulers in high places.
You know what? I'd have to agree with both of you implicitly on that one.
Okay. John,
I have one more.
Anita.
Okay,
go ahead.
I have one more thing I want to say. John, you were mentioning in certain counties like LaBar, I think you said King and Kennedy, and in Texas and another county in Hawaii, that they have zero population, but that we have as many sheriffs as we do counties. How does a sheriff go about getting elected in a county where there's zero population?
Well, does he live there? Now I say zero population in Kilauea County, Hawaii. They actually, I say there's zero population. I think there's I think there's 80 some odd people in there. The sheriff was appointed by the state. And Kilimanu Wahambi is the current sheriff of that particular county. If an individual runs for sheriff and has his name put on the ballot. And remember, when you apply for a job anywhere, whether it's a grocery store, a defense contractor, a machine shop, or as a president, your prospective employer wants to see references. You go out and you get X amount of signatures on a ballot, endorsements saying, you know, that these are your character references for your application there. You know, the people walk up and say, can I use you as a reference on my job application? And then on the day that they set aside to hire, you know, whether it's November 6th or whatever, whether it's a special or a general election, they, all the employers, the government of the people, by the people, and for the people, decide, they sit down and they decide what they want to do. They can hire them. So there are some state or some counties, I've mentioned in Hawaii, Kalawao County, where the governor appointed the sheriff because nobody ran. But, you know, there's Petroleum County, Montana, that it was established and originally owned by various indigenous Indian tribes. Today, over 90% of the population is Caucasians, and they elected their sheriff, and there's only 400 and some odd residents. There's not even 500. So when the individuals apply for that job, they can vote and get hired. When nobody applies, the governor usually assigns it.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for all your answers. I appreciate it. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you. And next is Anita, followed by Miss Jennifer. And since they are best of buds, I've unmuted both their lines. But Anita goes first.
Hi, Jennifer.
Welcome back, young lady. So how you doing, youngster? Long time no hear.
Yeah, so answer that in a minute, Jennifer. Anyway, this question is for Michael. When you referred to the taxes that are legal under the Constitution, the first one was to tax every person equally. I think you said something like that. A portion. So
a portion. The constitutional word is apportionment.
Okay, so if they ever, from what I understand, do an apportionment, say it's decided that each person's apportionment is $2,000 or $100,000, can it legally be instituted under the Constitution?
John?
If one person pays a nickel, they all pay a nickel. There are some provisions that the way the taxation is meant that does not deprive an individual of their civil rights under color of law and or their unalienable rights. You know, that and it says we hold these truths to be self-evident that individuals are endowed with certain inalienable rights by their creator. And among these are life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Those are all inalienable or unalienable rights. And Justice Breshears has an interesting study that he does on the difference between inalienable and unalienable. But what happens is that if your tax in any way affects inalienable right, then the tax is not valid. So what happened was the framers of the Constitution said it's just a direct tax. And there's still some questions about taxes when they're not paid. What right, if it takes away a right, what does that make the tax? Is it legal or illegal? And like the income tax on an organic, living, breathing human being that has inalienable rights. Can you tax somebody to the place where if they don't pay that tax, that you can either take away the proceeds of that right or take away their liberty so that they can't exercise that right, meaning put them in jail? Now, does that mean that the tax is being improperly applied or that the right wasn't really a right? Does that help answer your question a little bit?
Well, it just adds more complication to the question. I think tonight I'm not going to try to get the answer, but I just don't understand what the government is allowed to do if they can do what's that called? And what'd you say, Michael?
Apportionment.
Apportionment. Thank you, Jennifer. If they can do that apportionment, can they make it anything they want to?
Yes, they can. but it might, apportionment must be equal. Meaning that go ahead, Michael.
I believe that Mr. Ed earlier had, in fact, I'm going to unmute him here since he seems to have some information on that. Mr. Ed, I've cleared your line. Mr. Ed mentioned earlier that that there had to be a something with specificity to it, that they had to say this is what it's for and then get the houses to pass it, et cetera. But, Ed, do you have anything else to add to that?
No, just the had to be a specific issue that couldn't be provided for, and they would do an apportion tax upon everybody. It would go
right,
to each
so
state.
I imagine
it would divide it up between the population of the state.
Mm-hmm. What if someone's earning $1 million and someone earns $100,000, and they decide the apportionment is $100,000? So the millionaire can pay that, but the person who only earns $100,000 gets no income at all left. So it doesn't make sense that someone who's poor has to pay the same amount as someone who's rich. Wouldn't it be better to do a percentage, like 10% of something, or not?
The founding fathers never imagined. Well, actually, I think they did. The government run amok and spending out of control. To them, an individual paying close to a nickel worth of taxes for anything was almost an abomination. Remember, the tea tax was less than 1 cent, and we all know how that party ended up. The fact is that there may be better ways to handle that, Jennifer, but this is the way it's established under the Constitution at the moment.
Hmm. Right. So they just didn't imagine that it would involve so much money potentially at some point. Okay. Thank you.
Remember, money's not the same today as it was back then. Some wild and crazy pair of citizens, two young gentlemen, were tasked with purchasing some property for a president that they only paid $15 million for.
That'll.
Yeah, remember the Louisiana purchase was $15 million.
Mm.
That was all less than 4 cents an acre. He had James Monroe and Robert Livingston. Thomas Jefferson had James Monroe and Robert Livingston negotiate that from Napoleon for $15 million.
Hmm. Robert Livingston was everywhere, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, if we're going to talk about names, Mr. Ed, please don't start bringing up names like Wilbur. That is so 60s.
Okay.
Well, actually,
Wilbur.
All right, Jennifer. Anything else?
Yeah. Well, my question is, I have maps that actually have the owner of a great lot in the Hardenberg patent as being R.R. Livingston, and that's the maps probably go for about 100 years, and they're different maps. But all showing the same great lot. And if I don't have deeds that are specific to any particular area in that great lot, is a map from the state of New York as valid for the chain of title, proving Livingston owned it because he owned a whole great lot, would that make the chain of title full rather than have a gap?
There are certain places, Jennifer, where that could be a solution. It takes the rest of the documentation to decide that.
The rest of my deed documentation or the rest of the map kind of documentation? What do you mean?
They have to work together. The deed and the maps all work together. Remember, the deeds define, and I'm going to use a vulgar term called the meets and bounds. They define the meets and bounds. The maps are where we look to find those meets and bounds.
Right. Okay.
Okay. They have to work together.
Okay. And I just wanted to make a statement that I just made up my own letter and sent to the IRS. And I just asked the question. Well, I said, could you help me understand the income tax filing requirements for American nationals? And here's a copy of my affidavit, my travel passport, card numbers, this. And do I, Jennifer Sue Hansen, oh, I shouldn't have said my name, have any tax filing obligations or not? If I do, please tell me which forms to use. And if I don't, let me know. So it was basically just asking them for help in determining the status of the American national. Is that okay to say?
You're doing very well, Jennifer. You're asking questions, and you're asking the right questions. And that talk that we had a little while back, I can see that none of our talks ever fall on deaf ears. You go, girl. You rock. You and Anita, boy, you guys are full 10 pointers in my book. It, okay, you can stay. Yeah, that's the right way to do it. And for the rest of you, if you want to know how to move forward and proceed on some of those things, just make an appointment with Michael and let's talk, and we'll see what we can do to help each of you, because there's certain questions that are 40,000 foot to ask in those types of letters, and there's certain that are 10 foot questions. We want to make sure that you ask the right questions if you're going to do this properly.
Well, hopefully my questions were good enough, but I just sent it on the 11th and I got my certified notice back that they received it on the 17th. So we'll see if they respond at all.
Well, praise the King. We'll look forward to your response.
Thank you. I look forward to my response too.
All right.
Okay.
Any closing comments, John? Brother John?
Things aren't always as they appear to be. Sometimes you walk onto the used car lot. Sometimes you walk into the used car lot and that car has a nice paint job. This bright candy apple red and those mag rims and has all this pinstriping and fascinating, and the interior looks like it's leather and it's been rubbed out. But the engine and the transmission don't run worth diddly, and you can barely get it out of the parking lot. There's times where something, is that a Volkswagen? It looks like it's sitting down a little bit low in the back. Oh, what is this? This has a V8 in it? Holy kitty litter, Batman. This thing doesn't even have a good paint job. The properties that we may consider may look good, may be attractive. Oh, this one's by the water. Oh, look at the trees that one's next to. This one's near work. Look at this one. It's right on the edge of the forest. And there can be issues that are beneficial and constructive, and there can be some that can be problematic. I encourage people to not go hunting for a spouse by how he or she looks. I mean, hunting for property by on its curb appeal. All of a sudden finding out after purchase that the foundation, this was a slab foundation, it has multiple severe cracks in it where the water is coming up through the foundation, and but it sure looked good on the outside. Finding out what the title is and doing the research in advance quietly, so that if you all of a sudden find out that this car, that engine transmission are just in fabulous condition, we don't really want to alert the used car salesman to the fact that we know he's got a jewel in his parking lot. We want to just quietly go up there and acquire it, okay? You can hire title companies to do all this advanced work. The problem is that now they put that in their database and everybody has access to it. There's times where I've made comments that there's certain tasks that if you already own the property, having the title company go into it is very different than am I thinking about purchasing this and not having a title company go into it so that everybody else is aware of the jewel that you found, treasure you found buried in that field. You know, you're just going to go by the field, you know, quietly and pick it up. Do your due diligence. Buyer beware. Ask the Father for wisdom and guidance. There could be the most attractive looking, beautiful, even the Elodia title has already been established in Elodium, but there's something that's going to be problematic with that property, like, oh, it's at the base of a volcano called Kilauea, and the next lava flow is going to collapse all of the previous lava tubes, and the flow is now going to come through this neighborhood, but nobody's going to know for another 7.5 years. And respectfully and regrettably, I'm talking about a very specific young lady that purchased that property that was certain it was going to be the best. She's now 71, when Kilauea cleared her throat back in the 80s, her wonderful precious property that she used the proceeds when her husband passed away from his life insurance, and she quit teaching and took everything they had and invested in it. And two people that I know personally said, Jeannie, don't buy that. You don't want that. Oh, no problem. We've checked on it. But look what's happened. You know, and they had some ideas. Do your due diligence and ask the Father for his guidance on whatever you do. Back to you, Michael.
I'm enough. I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening and remind you to be returning if you are able tomorrow night, when Mr. Slevin will be sharing with us his most unique LLC. You all must be aware of this, because this LLC is a tool that you can use if you're an employee to be free as a worker. You heard that, not being an employee, but as a worker. And how does that work? Well, if you have the LLC, then you can work for the LLC. Your employer saves money, and everyone is happy. You take back control of your life. So until then, thank you, everyone, for joining us. Martin, thank you so much for your beginnings tonight. And we're going to be having you back again tomorrow night and thereafter, and you'll just get better and better and better at this. Until then, good night, everyone. And
good night,
be well. Good night.
Night, Martin.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you.